This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's been a wild week in the news, and it just keeps coming. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez in deep, and the Justice Department under the gun.
I acknowledge that mistakes were made here. I accept that responsibility.
The Pentagon says Khalid Sheikh Mohammed confessed not only to 9/11, but 27 other terrorist plots, from plans to kill Pope John Paul to the beheading of reporter Daniel Pearl.
He said he was behind the bombing of a nightclub in Bali, the shoe bombing plot to blow up U.S. airliners over the Atlantic, and plans to attack the Sears Tower in Chicago and New York's Empire State Building.
And an Iraq pullout resolution stumbles in the Senate, but not without impassioned pleas here from Democrat Joe Biden.
It's about time we have the courage to stand up and say to the president, Mr. President, you have not only put us in harm's way, you have harmed us. You have no policy, Mr. President.
This hour on Point, our news roundtable goes behind the headlines. We have a great and distinguished panel with us this week. From Sacramento, California, Tim Grieve is here, senior writer at Salon.com, Bigfoot writer on Salon's War Room blog. Spent a lot of time with us in the run-up to the 04 election. Tim Grieve, good to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, it's good to be back.
With us from New York, power player and media mogul Mortimer Zuckerman. He's editor-in-chief of U.S. News & World Report, chairman and co-publisher of the New York Daily News, swings a big stick in many worlds. Mort Zuckerman, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, hello.
It's good to have you. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty joins us to dive in on a week in the news. Jack, good to have you here.
Thank you, Tom. Hello, Tim. And a special welcome to Mort. Nice to have you on the show.
Hey, thanks, Jack. How are you?
Just fine.
Let's dive right in on Alberto Gonzalez a little bit here, back to back from Chuck Schumer and Karl Rove. First, Charles Schumer.
The new emails show conclusively that Karl Rove was in the middle of this mess from the beginning. It is now imperative that he testify before Congress and give all the details of his involvement.
Karl Rove says it's all politics.
This, to my mind, is a lot of politics, and I understand that's what Congress has a right to play around with, and they're going to do it. And I just ask the American people and ask Congress to look fairly and carefully at what's being said and done now.
Tim Grieve, let me come straight to you in Sacramento. Is Alberto Gonzalez toast? Is he out? Should he be?
Well, he should be. Whether he will be, that's a big question. You know, we have three congressional Republicans now are calling for his ouster. But as I noted at Salon earlier this week, you know, a lot of congressional Republicans have been calling for a different course in Iraq, and that hasn't really changed things with this administration. So I think it's still too early to know.
If he goes out on the merits or out for misrepresenting the sort of chain of events here that led to these firings, Tim?
Well, I think there's a pretty good argument that he should go for both reasons. But I think if he does go, it will be because he and so many others in the administration did misrepresent what went on with the firings.
Mort Zuckerman, how do you look at this? I mean, step back for us here. The talk of we want loyal Bushies in there in the email exchange. It's now in front of everybody, senators in high dudgeon, Karl Rove and other Republicans saying, come on, they serve the U.S. attorneys at the pleasure of the president. How do you see it, Mr. Zuckerman?
Well, as a matter of whether or not this is a part of the common practice with respect to U.S. attorneys, I think we have to take into account the fact that when Janet Reno came in as attorney general, she had all 92 or 93 U.S. attorneys dismissed and replaced them with people who were more, shall we say, to her liking. It is a presidential appointment. They do serve at the pleasure of the president, and therefore to remove them is entirely within the purview of the president and his representatives. However, that does not excuse what went on, which is an unbelievable performance and a maladroit one to such a degree that you have to scratch your head and wonder if those people know how to play the game. There was no need for them to misrepresent to the Congress what in fact went on. They should have said, yes, we replaced them for political reasons. That's the way it goes in this world. We replace the U.S. attorneys, and we have the right to. They're presidential appointments. But to basically misrepresent the fact that, gosh almighty, politics was involved is ridiculous. And it really does make you wonder, where do these people come from? Do they not have any understanding of how this process works? And that, in fact, what they have done is what, in a sense, Scooter Libby did and what Martha Stewart did, which was to lie about something which wasn't a crime. So I think what you have here is another example of the sheer incompetence of this administration that has been so pervasive in the way that they have run this government. I mean, Alberto Gonzalez has somehow or other demonstrated that he is completely unequal to the job of Attorney General of the United States, that Karl Rove was playing politics with this. Well, I'm shocked, shocked, shocked. But that's perfectly appropriate. What is not even understandable is why they had to screw this thing up to the point where they made all of these misrepresentative representations to both the Republicans and to the Democrats. I mean, Arlen Specter was as outraged at this as Chuck Schumer.
Yeah, real outrage in the Senate. The sense that they've got hold here of a thread that could unravel what's been a pattern of misrepresentation. The White House stonewalling early in the week, though later it came out in all kinds of directions about these emails. But here's Tony Snow at a press conference just yesterday saying, again, it's within the president's power to remove U.S. attorneys.
They've got a four-year term. Each of these folks had fulfilled the four-year term. There are holdover provisions, but it is well within the president's executive authority to replace people.
Jack Peedy, hey, we screwed up in the way we told you about it. Sorry, may even have lied, it looks like, but it's within our power. Nothing unprecedented here. What do you say, Jack?
There is something unprecedented. I mean, according to a study by the Congressional Research Bureau, there have been 54 U.S. attorneys appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate who left office before completing a four-year term over the last 25 years. And those 54 left for various reasons, taking judgeships, going back to the private sector, running for office. There were eight who left before completing a four-year term. They come down finally to this, that there were two of these 54 were dismissed by the president, two of 54, and three resigned after news reports indicated they had engaged in questionable personal practices, and of three others, they knew nothing. So here you have basically at a maximum of five U.S. attorneys leaving, being fired in midterm or leaving in midterm without apparently at the president's instigation in out of 54. It is not a common practice in midterm, and the reason is precisely because it gives the appearance of political interference. Sure, when a president comes in, he names his new team. Then they go ahead. But if you remove a U.S. attorney before that term or within the president's term, before his term is up or while the president's term is still going, you get a situation where you can look as if you're interfering in prosecutions they're undertaking for political reasons. And that's why this practice of not replacing people in midterm is, in fact, the customary practice to avoid the appearance of presidents getting involved in political interfering in U.S. attorney investigations for political
reasons. Right in the midst
precisely what we see in this case.
A lot of people really steamed about that. The president asked about it even in Mexico this week, standing next to the Mexican president Calderon. Here's President Bush on the scandal.
I do have confidence in Attorney General Al Gonzalez. I talked to him this morning, and we talked about his need to go up to Capitol Hill and make it very clear to members in both political parties why the Justice Department made the decisions it made, make it very clear about the facts. And he's right, mistakes were made. And I'm frankly not happy about them.
Tim Grieve, two Republican senators, never mind all the Democrats, now saying Gonzalez should go, Republican Senators Gordon and Sununu. Do you see the support for him on Capitol Hill? The reporting says, hey, you know, outside the Oval Office, where he's been with the president from the get-go, way back to Texas, do you see the support to keep him in this spot?
Yeah, I don't know that he really has any support on Capitol Hill. I think people are so put off by what has been a real pattern of dishonesty on this. We're not seeing other Republicans beyond those two and one in the House of Representatives at this point calling for his resignation. But I don't think it's going to take much more. The Justice Department has misled on this case. They've had three or four opportunities to testify before Congress, and each time the stories they've told have turned out not to be true. So there's just no reservoir, and I don't think there really has been ever much of a reservoir of support for Gonzalez on the Hill.
Let's listen in for just a minute on the debate in the Senate this week over the war, Iraq, and whether the Senate should intervene. Here's Senate Minority Leader Republican Mitch McConnell, Kentucky, saying yesterday that the Democrats' proposed resolution, which would get troops withdrawn, was a mistake.
It is a clear statement of retreat, from the support that the Senate only recently gave to General David Petraeus, and its passage would be absolutely fatal to our mission in Iraq.
Senator Dick Durbin, a Democrat, Illinois, said Republicans are the only ones, his words, who want American troops to stay in Iraq.
Who wants America to come home at this point? The American people do. The Iraqi people want us to leave. In fact, the Iraqi leadership has said it is time for you to start withdrawing our troops. The resistance to bringing our troops home comes from the other side of the aisle and from the White House.
Dick Durbin, it's just those Republican, elected Republicans in the White House. Mortimer Zuckerman, what do you make of the congressional debate at this point on Iraq? The war is an issue. The Constitution and powers are an issue. How do you see it?
Well, I do think that this is primarily a political issue, not a constitutional issue. I don't think there's any way that the Congress can interpret its role to preclude the role of the commander-in-chief. No commander-in-chief can fight a war and have it argued over in detail and determined in detail by a body as loose and as responsive to short-term political concerns as the Congress.
But the power of the purse is there. They do have that responsibility.
Yes, they do have that responsibility, and it has never been the case in the history of the United States that the Congress of the United States has withdrawn funding for troops in the field. And I don't think the Democrats are going to do it this time either. As you have seen, they do not have the votes to do that. And there are a number of Democrats, the Blue Dog Democrats, as they call them, who are actually opposed to that possible legislation. I'm whatever else you may feel about the war in Iraq, and it was as badly executed as almost anything we have ever done. It is such a catastrophe of malexecution. Jerry Bremer, as Newt Gingrich himself said, was perhaps one of the worst foreign policy appointments in the history of the United States. And I think the way that this war was conducted by people whom we would have otherwise thought were really quite competent based on their record. I mean, Don Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, Colin Powell, these are people who at least gave the appearance of experience and competence. They have screwed this up to a degree that leaves you breathless. But we're in it now. And what may have been a war of choice, in my judgment today, is a war of necessity. Even Hillary Clinton, I think, recognizes the risk to our national interests and national security were there to be a precipitous or even a defined date of withdrawals, because I think the risk that parts of this country would become another haven for terrorists, this time with oil money to fuel it, is just too great. The risk that Iran would expand its influence into the Shiite portion of Iraq is just too great. The risk that we would undermine the moderates in the Arab world, especially the Sunnis who support us, and inspire and incentivize the radicals, it's just too great. The risk that Turkey and Kurdistan would get into some kind of major confrontation and we would lose the relationship, a critical relationship we have with Turkey, is just too great. I could go on and on in all of this. So I'm saying that the risks of leaving in the wrong way are so great that we simply must be careful about how we do that. And you cannot make these decisions on the basis of popular opinion. We may be a democracy, but the people who run this country and run the government and particularly run our foreign policy have to take a longer view of it than what is a short-term political view.
So maybe all that, clearly of necessity, politics involved here, but also some very different views from the Senate this week. Let's hear a little more from Joe Biden. He was on fire on this. Here he is with a passionate plea on Iraq.
We're taking sides in a civil war. I was there in Srebrenica. I was in Tuzla. I was in Sarajevo. I was in Brčko in the Balkans. How did we solve that? We solved that with a policy of separating the parties. This is a cycle of self-sustaining sectarian violence that 20,000, 30,000, 50,000, 100,000 Americans will not be able to stop. Mr. President, this is ridiculous. There is no plan. I ask the President, everyone else that comes forward with a plan, whether it's capping or surging or whatever they have, will have answered the two-word test. Then what? Then what? Then what?
There's Joe Biden on the Senate floor and worked up. Jack Beatty, Boston Globe, now reporting that General Petraeus in Iraq wants a bigger surge, more troops here. You hear the arguments on both sides. Do you think the Democrats are going to get around this and push back against the war effectively, or will it just be resolutions until presidential elections again?
I think so. There will be resolutions. Each one will be a tough vote for Republicans. And, you know, in 2008, we'll call it. If 2006 is predictive, it'll mean a defeat for many Republican incumbents for supporting those resolutions. But to get back to this idea of the risks of leaving, what about the risks of staying? I mean, I was struck this week by a Time story that said that the political accommodations that we had hoped the Iraqi government would have made by now, and which they had promised to make, they have not made. They, on de-bathification, on hiring back people who had fired in that big mass firing.
The administration is saying they're many months behind on that very recent timetable.
Many months behind on that, on other things. And why? Well, because somebody else is doing their work for them. We are. Uncle Sam is. Our troops are. We're taking the lead. So long as that is true, they have no incentive, the Shiite government, to make the kinds of accommodations with the Sunnis that could bring about the kind of political settlement that allow us to get our troops out. In short, we're giving them entirely the wrong incentives. So the longer we stay under these terms, the less incentive they have to make the kinds of changes that have to be made to get our troops out.
And we heard John Murtha saying something like that this week in the House. Tim Grieve, do you see the House coming up with something different here?
Well, it's possible the House will come up with something different. The Democrats are so far somewhat divided on this. There's the plan that cleared out of the House Appropriations Committee yesterday would lead to a withdrawal by August 2008 at the latest, earlier if certain benchmarks aren't made. More liberal Democrats want a withdrawal by the end of the year. For the House to get something out of the House, the Democrats are going to need to come together on that. I think it's possible that they will, but as everyone else is saying, it's sort of a dead letter. It doesn't really matter because it's not going to get out of the Senate. And even if it did, the president would veto it. So everything that's happening now is largely symbolic. And I think that's going to remain as long as Iraq remains sort of this dull, aching sore, but not sort of an acute problem at any moment for the American public.
More to say there, but there's so much on the boards. Let's go to our callers. Nashville, Tennessee. Robert, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm an 8-year veteran of the first Gulf War, and I came out as gay while serving and eventually left with an honorable discharge after serving my full term.
Right.
In a recent Military.com survey, 23% of the respondents supported gays in the military. Well, my question is, what would happen to military readiness if all of those 23% just came out? Because when I was in the military, the gay service members usually volunteered for the most dangerous jobs, so that the dads and the moms who are friends on board ship or fighting in the trenches would be able to go home to their families.
Robert, let me ask you, so when you heard General Peter Pace, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, say on Monday, I believe homosexual acts between two individuals are immoral and that we should not condone immoral acts. Top general here, you served, you're gay. What was your response?
Well, I was very offended because I volunteered to be on reactor safeguards team on my ship. So if the reactor was melting down, I would be the person going in there saving everyone else. Firefighter, chemical biological warfare, you know, all the most dangerous things. So if he thinks that's immoral, you know, then he's going to lose the hardest core of his fighting force.
Robert, thanks very much for calling. Tim Grieve, how about it? The Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy has already seen a bunch of Arab linguists kicked out and others who seem to be critical. The military clearly has huge manpower, woman power needs here. Can we afford right now to have military policy driven by General Peter Pace's private view of morality?
Well, clearly we can't, and there's at least a little irony that at the same moment we're tossing out, and I guess if you're Peter Pace, would like to toss out even more gay men and women from the military, we're opening up the standards to let in more people with decreased educational accomplishments, with criminal backgrounds. We're sending soldiers back into the field who are too injured to actually wear their body armor. When we're doing things like that, it would suggest that we don't have the luxury, even if in some world you thought it was a good idea to be tossing out people because who they sleep with.
Jack Beatty, what do you make of this? At this point, 2007, I mean, the general's entitled to his view, but, you know, people say, well, humans are born this way or become this way very early on, and he's tagging them as immoral for being, they might say, what they are. I mean, you wouldn't do that to women. You wouldn't do it to people of a certain race. Here's the chief of staff.
A primitive effusion, I mean, without any sense to it at all. You know, God wouldn't have made something. It's like indicting nature. But, you know, when I was really disappointed, I mean, I didn't expect much better from him, but Hillary Clinton's response really disappointed me. Hillary Clinton knows gay couples who've been married and loving for years, and yet when she was first asked about this, she gave a sort of rote response about gays in the military and we need to have them, and we certainly do. That ban should come down. But she wouldn't come right out and answer the question, is homosexuality, in your view, immoral? And it was only a day later that she said, oh, well, you know, my friends have called me and they said that I should say it's not immoral. Mm. It was the kind of crafted, you know, I'm not going to go any further than I have to statement that more and more people are seeing as typical of her candidacy, cautious to a fault. And indeed, when she said it, she said, well, as John Warner said, she was looking for protection from John Warner to assert that homosexuality was not immoral. I thought it was a profile in something
other than courage. Mort,
yeah.
Zuckerman, do we ever get over this culture war piece? You've got the retired chief of staff, General John Shalikashvili, saying, you know, he's ready to acknowledge gays in the military now, but here's Peter Pace. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I do think that if obviously that is his view, but he ought to have had the wisdom to restrain himself because it is not the military policy. It will not be the military policy. And all it does is really upset and disappoint a lot of people, frankly, on both sides of the issue. It just raises an issue that at this point should be allowed to sort of sink quietly into the mist and let's learn how to live comfortably with the current policy. I really find, again, this administration at all levels to be demonstrably incompetent in sort of defusing issues. Instead, they seem to intensify issues. It's just stupid beyond belief, and I do think that this is just one of a whole list of screw-ups that at this point you can't even be surprised by. I find it really astonishing that this has to become an issue at this stage of the game, given all of the other problems that we have, simply because this man didn't have the wisdom to keep his mouth shut.
With all these headlines crowding in, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let me take a call from Peter in Westwood, Massachusetts. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just want to point out that it's interesting that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, you know, after 4 years of interrogation and torture, just this week broke down and told all. I mean, this was the week that was full of black eyes for the White House. And it seems to me that they're taking a page out of their, you know, their playbook from the 04 campaign, of looking to divert attention from embarrassing issues by, you know, suddenly, you know, surfacing.
Out of the black box of Guantanamo comes every confession under the sun.
Right. I was wondering if your guests see any pattern here.
Tim Grieve, I'll put it to you.
Well, there is a pattern, and it's actually worse than that. It's not just that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed came out with these things this week. He came out with them a long time ago. We all knew about these confessions, and they were surfaced this week. So that's the truly curious thing. But, you know, he has now confessed, if you believe the Pentagon and if you believe him, to everything but killing Nicole Brown Simpson and Anna Nicole Smith. So this guy is I guess, supposed to be the end of our terror wars. I don't know. But there's exactly this kind of pattern. We saw it in the run-up to the 2004 2004 election with the manipulation of terror alerts. We see whenever things start to go badly for the president or for Dick Cheney, constant invocations of 9/11. This terror card just gets played again and again and again. And you know, at some point you have to be skeptical. And I think that point passed a long time ago when you start hearing the administration talking about these kind of things. You have to start wondering, well, what is it that they don't want to be talking about right now?
Mort Zuckerman, what do you make of both the timing and the confessions themselves? A trail kind of, you know, back to original sin practically here. Could one man be that central, be the be-all and end-all of the terror world?
Well, I suppose it's conceivable. I mean, he was chief of operations for al-Qaeda when they were the principal player in the world of terrorism against the United States and against the U.S. allies all around the world. And there was a period of time, if you look at Lawrence Wright's book, when they were really the major player, and he was a critical member of that elite group. Mm-hmm. So anything is possible. It's hard really if and I assume that this is at least an accurate description of what he said without necessarily validating everything that he said. Mm. There's no doubt but that he was central to a lot of the terrorist activities of al-Qaeda and was a coup for us to have captured him in Pakistan as we did. And undoubtedly we did uncover a lot of details about that al-Qaeda organization and operation. What it does, however, it seems to me, go to, besides the unfortunate interpretation of everything this administration does as political, and they've earned the disrespect that goes with that. The fact is, we are faced with a long range threat from people like this and groups like Al Qaeda, and they're not the only ones today who are playing in this terrible world of terrorism. And we are going to have to find ways to confront this. This is not, as we know, in criminal law, you know, you wait for the crime to be committed and then you pursue the criminal and prosecute him. But when you have people who are willing to commit suicide in the process of doing immense damage to us, there's nobody to convict afterwards. They're all dead. And so you've got to find some way to cope with it.
Here's President Bush practicing that Espanol with Mexican President Felipe Calderón in Spanish.
Estamos encantados de estar en México otra vez.
And Patti Smith is out there. Oh, no, excuse me. What have I got queued up here? Oh, Daily Show. Jon Stewart had this to say about Republican Nebraska Senator Chuck Hagel with his press conference announcing his maybe future plans to announce a run for president. Jon Stewart.
And the date on which I will make that announcement will be announced at a press conference in the indeterminate future. For more information, in the meantime, please consult my website, which will be up as soon as I announce a domain name, which I have no intention of doing now.
And here's Patti Smith, inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame on Monday night in New York. Her husband and bandmate Fred Sonic Smith once told her to expect this honor. He said,
"One day, you're going to get into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame." And I said, "Ah, no, I ain't." And he said, "Yes, you will. And you're not going to like it, or you might feel rebellious, or you might feel guilty because I'm not in it, and I'm clearly the better one."
Let's go to Burlington, Vermont, and Rick. Hi, Rick. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Great show. I wanted to ask Jack what his take on Clinton firing his attorneys back in 1993. Was that any way comparable to the situation today?
Yeah, we looked at a little bit of that, and it's one of those slippery things to figure out. We've heard legal experts on this show saying, not the same deal, but the question keeps coming, Jack.
It isn't the same deal. Presidents, when they start their term, have a right to do that, to make their appointments based on the patronage, based on political ideology, and they customarily do. Sometimes they leave certain members in whose term has yet to expire. So what Clinton did was at the beginning of his term. He did not, so far as I know, fire any U.S. attorneys within once they had begun. They served out their terms. This, as I said, 54 U.S. attorneys have been let go, have left in their midway in their terms in the last 25 years, but only five have left. Only two certainly have left because presidents have fired them. So Bush did more in one day than his in firing attorneys in midterm than his predecessors did in the last 25 years.
So there's a different pattern at the very least. Let's go to Beth calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. Beth, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My comment and question is about the debate on Iraq policy this week. It seems to me that a hallmark of the Bush administration's foreign policy is an over-reliance on force. And I wonder if opponents of the Iraq war are unintentionally reinforcing this narrow approach. It seems to me we have this polarized debate about whether to bring the troops home now or to quote Vice President Cheney, to stay until we have victory, quote-unquote victory.
Yeah, yeah.
And
so how is opposing it in Congress reinforcing a focus on force?
My comment is this. I listened to a hearing on Iraq funding a few weeks ago, and General Peter Pace was asked what level of troop surge would be sufficient, and his answer was essentially none, that Iraq policy is a three-legged stool, military, economy, and governance being the three legs. And I wonder if opponents of the war, of which I am one, would want to reframe it as rebalancing the stool. Because when we talk about just pulling the troops out, I think it's obvious to many people that that is not a sufficient answer.
Mm-hmm.
We owe a great debt to the Iraqi civilian population who have suffered so tremendously, and Iraq is now a hotbed of terrorism. It wasn't.
So how do you rebalance? Hillary Clinton saying this week, Ellen, that she would be in favor of a long-term troop presence there, a little different from what she said earlier. Is that part of rebalancing?
Well, it could be. The military, the troop level is part of it, but other parts are, for example, where are contracts for rebuilding the country going? Are they going to Iraqi individuals and companies? Are they going to foreign companies? It just seems to me that we have to look at these other aspects of Iraq policy with similar attention, because force alone, I think it's been clearly proven that's what gets us into trouble.
Yeah, let us pick it up. Tim Grieve, how about it? Republicans... not happy with the progress of the war, and Democrats certainly not happy. Do you see a kind of rebalancing that's just shy of this, you know, in or out conversation emerging effectively here?
Well, it won't emerge effectively, but to be fair to the Democratic critics of the war, most of the proposals to withdraw the troops have been coupled with language calling for a renewed, if it is indeed renewed, not just new, diplomatic effort and other sort of social economic efforts in Iraq. So the critics, I think, are aware that the stool needs to be rebalanced. And I think that just kind of gets lost in the shorthand conversations about, you know, arbitrary troop withdrawal deadlines and that sort of thing.
Mort Zuckerman, Vice President Cheney before AIPAC this week, talking to the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, you know, again suggesting that if you weren't for this war, you weren't for the troops, and saying if you're for Israel, you've got to back this war as well. Do you see a more nuanced view of what's going on there emerging from any quarter?
Look, I think the all aspects of the stool, the three prongs, the political, the economic, and the military, have been so mismanaged by this administration that it's really hard to figure out where you could make real progress. You will recall that Paul Bremer, who was a coalition provisional authority head that was nominated, who in the first couple of weeks de-bathified, that is, eliminated the Ba'ath Party, basically decapitated the military and the Iraqi police and left us in a horrible position. Also, at one point, brought $12 billion in cash to Iraq, most of which seems to have disappeared.
But what about now, Mort? What do we do? Well, I mean, do you see something?
The question is now. It is going to be a very, very, very difficult thing to do. It is, on my judgment, it is, and a lot of others, I think, it is a very dangerous thing to withdraw on any kind of a schedule. We're going to have to just work with this problem and work the problem as best we can. And try and establish some level of stability there so that when we gradually withdraw, which eventually we will, we don't see a bloodbath in Iraq, and Iraq taken over by terrorist groups that would essentially be coming after us, if not directly, going after the Sunnis or going after the Arab countries that were and are allies of the United States. So we have a terribly we have very bad choices at this stage of the game because of how everything was mismanaged. There will be, I think, a slow and steady improvement in the economy. But there's going to be no major economic gains in that country until there is some diminution of the violence. And, you know, when you hear Joe Biden saying, well, we've got to separate the three populations, it's almost impossible to do that. You know, Baghdad, for example, which is close to the Sunni heartland, also has 65% of the population who are Shiite. What do you do? Do you take a 3 or 4 million people and just move them away?
I mean, well, it's well begun. I mean, tons are out of the country, whole neighborhoods set fire. Now a kind of ethnic cleansing already pretty well underway.
Well, but there are 2 million people who have mostly middle and professional Iraqis who have left the country, moved to other Arab countries, Syria and et cetera,
yeah.
Because, of course, they are voting with their feet. They don't want to live in this kind of world of chaos and terrorism and murder. So I think Iraq is bleeding in every different direction. The most talented people in that country, and there was a relatively educated population there, they're leaving because they have that choice. So everything is going to be dependent at some point or another on establishing some level of security. And whether we're going to be able to do that with this surge and with the forces that David Petraeus is looking for, I don't know. If there's one military person, however, to have confidence in, it is David Petraeus, and people who have known the way he has functioned in that part of the world have more confidence in him than anybody else. But we don't know whether it's going to work. All I'm saying is we don't walk away and just really contribute to what is essentially a vacuum that is going to implode on us in various horrible
ways. A good Petraeus record, but wow, what he's up against now. And these numbers of troops, even with the additional ones he's reportedly in the Boston Globe asking for, you know, it's not like some big increase here. But here's John McCain, and then Jack, I'll come to you. Here's the Republican senator, Arizona, at the Firefighters Convention in Washington on Wednesday, talking about the Iraq War.
The hour is late. The situation is indeed dire, but all of us have a responsibility to withstand despair and the allure of partisanship, to make sound, informed judgments about how to proceed from here.
Jack, how do you look at where we proceed and politics here? Is Hillary Clinton tacking towards some middle position on Iraq now?
Probably, but, you know, to get back to the stool analogy, one leg is in conflict with the others, and that is the open-ended commitment. The politics, it's strategic incoherence. We want the government there to make accommodations. So long as we give them an open-ended, no-condition backing, they won't make those accommodations, which means we will have to stay longer. But, you know, you mentioned Cheney's speech at AIPAC. And one observer there basically said, if you want us on Iran, support us on Iraq. He was basically saying that to these delegates who want a strong stand against Iran. But I'm looking at a poll from the Gallup organization that says American Jews are at the top of the list of major religious groups who oppose the war. So he was not talking to people then, and apparently he wasn't all that well received on the Iraq question. On the Iran question, the original House bill or resolution said that the president has to come back to Congress to get permission to attack Iran if something should arise. That's now been dropped. That was dropped because of lobbying from New York congressmen and from the Blue Dogs. And that happened just at the time that Hillary Clinton was making at AIPAC a very strong statement on we can't let Iran have nuclear weapons. Barack Obama was saying the same thing. And I'm just worried that Mr. Cheney is going to look at that and say, well, here are the Democratic contenders saying tough stuff on Iran. Here's the Democratic House taking out the come back to Congress for permission on Iran resolution. It seems to me this gives ammunition to the Cheney side in pushing a confrontation with Iran.
I want to keep our listeners in here. Ellen's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Ellen, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
My top story of the week is definitely Gonzalez, but my bigger story is Karl Rove, and I wanted the panel to help me understand why he is impervious from subpoenas, and, you know, he just seems to be the new Teflon man.
Tim Grieve, I believe the White House is already suggesting that, subpoena or not, Rove will not come up to Capitol to testify. Have I got that right? And why? Is it flaking off at this point, or is he still invulnerable, bulletproof?
Well, they're certainly trying to keep him bulletproof. The story of Rove in this is just incredible. You know, first the White House said, or the Justice Department said, you know, this whole firing thing, it was just a Justice Department deal that originated with us. Then it comes out that it actually, the White House says, originated with Harriet Myers, but it was only her idea. And now it's pretty clear that it was at least Rove and Myers together coming up with this idea. And so he was involved from the very beginning. You know, the White House was out there saying he wasn't involved, exactly like whatever it was 3-4 years ago that they had Scott McClellan out there saying that Rove wasn't involved in the outing of Valerie Plame. It turns out he was. You know, so this keeps happening, and he is impervious. I mean, he's a little like Alberto Gonzalez. He's you know, an absolutely trusted confidant of the president. But unlike Gonzalez, Rove has, at least until this last round of elections, been pretty effective for the president. So it's hard to see Bush doing anything but continuing to protect Rove.
Speaking of Valerie Plame, she's breaking her silence today, testifying this morning before the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee. After all that, here's outed CIA operative Valerie Plame.
I love my career because I love my country. I was proud of the serious responsibilities entrusted to me as a CIA covert operations officer, and I was dedicated to this work. It was not common knowledge on the Georgetown cocktail circuit that everyone knew where I worked. But all of my efforts on behalf of the national security of the United States, all of my training, all of the value of my years of service were abruptly ended when my name and identity were exposed irresponsibly.
Scooter Libby convicted and Valerie Plame there now talking. Let's go to Norwood, New York. And Carl, hi, Carl, you're on the air.
Hello and thank you. And my first comment is credit where credit's due to Mort Zuckerman, because Mr. Zuckerman, the McLaughlin Group is one of the few shows that reward my time spent watching, and thank you for your part.
Thank you very much.
Which appears to be a question but has its own answer is, in 6 years of this regime, question is, what have they done right? It appears that for 6 years, every week brings a fresh stain, a shocking story of mismanagement, incompetence, and even Alice in Wonderland, Condoleezza Rice, she said, for the record, we never imagined that people would commandeer aircraft and use them as bombs, when the record by April, May 01 showed, yes, there were advance warnings trickling in. The point is, we've got Katrina, where a world-class capital magnet city became a third world sewer with people still suffering today. We've got What Can Brown Do For You? We've got Scooter Libby. Now we've got the Attorney General, the people's lawyer of the nation, embroiled in this. We've got a semi-literate who can't speak normal English, let alone Spanish. And my point is, this is familiar, all of it, because in 73, I watched Watergate daily. And when John Dean testified, he used the buzzword, there's a cancer on the White House.
Carl, our time is running straight out. Mort Zuckerman, pick it up. Is this a Watergate-style unraveling, or are we watching the clock run out on this administration all the way to the end?
No, I don't think it's a Watergate-style unraveling. I do think it is an administration which has been characterized by a level of incompetence that certainly not only challenged but surpassed the Jimmy Carter administration for incompetence, which I never thought would happen. I'm just astounded that in the areas where we thought and hoped they would have some level of competence, which was in national security matters, given the people whom they brought in, they were as incompetent as any administration we've ever had. It is just staggering. And, of course, you could add Hurricane Katrina. Just the idea of nominating Harriet Myers for the Supreme Court is an example. The Dubai ports thing, and now we see it again with the Walter Reed and medical care. So it just goes on forever, and I suspect it's going to continue to go on until this administration is blessedly retired.
Well, we're going to sit down with Republicans on Monday and ask them how they see what's going on here. Get it straight from the party. Mort Zuckerman, editor-in-chief at U.S. News and World Report, it's been great to have you this hour. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Tim Grieve, senior writer at Salon, at salon.com's War Room blog. Tim, great to have you.
My pleasure.
And Jack Beatty, always great to have you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.